एक मिनट रुक जाओ, रेडी होने दो। चलो ये कर लेते हैं, दिस कुड बी अ ग्रेट इंट्रो।
हाय, आई एम अक्षय।
हाय, दिस इज सौरभ एंड यू आर लिसनिंग टू द फाउंडर थीसिस पॉडकास्ट। वी मीट सम ऑफ द मोस्ट सेलिब्रेटेड स्टार्टअप फाउंडर्स इन द कंट्री
एंड वी वांट टू लर्न हाउ टू बिल्ड अ यूनिकॉर्न।
Hi Akshay, I'm Shauravi. I am the co-founder of Slurp Farm along with my dear friend Meghna.
As India becomes more developed, its people also demand better products and services. And this creates the opportunity for startups to create products that cater to the needs of the new Indian consumer who is able to spend more for a healthier lifestyle. Shauravi Malik is someone who saw both India and the West and then built a company to bridge the gap between them. She started Slurp Farm, both out of a personal passion for creating healthier eating options for consumers and from a deeper understanding of the FMCG space and seeing the opportunity to build a new age brand. Listen to this fascinating masterclass on setting up a direct-to-consumer startup in India with Shauravi Malik and Akshay Dutt.
So in Cambridge, you know, what was like the plan, like once you landed there, did you want to work in the UK only, or did you think that I'll go back to India and find a job, or, you know, like what happened then?
You know, I didn't have any such preconceived notions at all. If I'm really like, if I look back at how time was at that time, I think we lived in the early sort of 2002 to 2004, right? Banking was at its peak. So it was not so much a conscious decision as the most sort of visible employer on campus were the 30 investment banks at the time. And I would say, I wish that thinking about your career and life choices was a more deliberative thing that one did when they were 18, 19. I think a large degree of what happened around sort of my early 20s was whatever was happening around you sort of engage with that, right? And there was so much of it on campus, and there was so much campus recruitment, next job. And I would say it started with my internship. I did a summer internship and I enjoyed it so much.
In an investment bank?
At JP Morgan. And then I said, okay, I want to come back and work here. And that's actually all there was to it. There was no like, where am I going to live? What is it going to mean? I don't know. I think it was more the, I loved my job. I loved what I did. And that's all it followed from there. I switched sides and made a conscious decision to work on the mergers and acquisitions team. So it was consumer, healthcare, retail, M&A. And really, like, it was such a, so much fun that I don't know if you realize it when you're that young, right? My first ever meeting was the CEO of Carlsberg. I almost overslept and missed the flight because I had worked till 4 a.m. And then the second time, like, I don't know, all kinds of, like, exciting things that I feel investment banking gives you like a ringside view to at a very young age. It has actually been the formative sort of thought process for now, but I didn't know it back then. Right from like, I still remember my boss, I was going out for dinner and he called me and he's like, you've got to finish this whatever DCF model by tomorrow morning. It was like first month into the job. And I was like, I don't know how to build a DCF model. He's like, you'll know by tomorrow morning. Like, okay, shit. Like, okay. Yeah. So I went back to office, found someone, you know, very kindly sat up with me all night and taught me what to do. And then next morning, I was like, here's my model. I have no idea what I did, but here's what it says. And so there was a lot of that. There was a lot of throwing people into the deep end. And I think it made you sort of grow up and take charge of situations pretty soon. I think it also taught you, again, like confidence with numbers. I'm never scared when I see any kind of Excel modeling, or, you know, even in the business, I would say both Meghna and I, till very recently, were always the people doing all of the number crunching. And I think it taught you that from, like, you fundamentally understand your business.
So you met Meghna also in JP Morgan?
No, I met Meghna because, interestingly, the same best friend's brother connected both of us. And he basically said, listen, there is this girl. She's great fun. She's having a Diwali party. You're both in London. Why don't you go? He was in Bombay. So, and I was like, Utsav, seriously? Like, I don't know her. I can't just land up at her house. He said, yes, you can land up at her house. so I was like, okay, I'll go. And I went to Meghna's house, and he was right. We got along really well. We threw every Diwali party for the next 3 years together, both of us. And we got along like a house on fire. And, you know, a lot of different ideas were in our head at that time. We talked a little bit about, oh, this job. And I moved from JP Morgan to Virgin. And Meghna used to work at McKinsey in London. And Meghna, I would say, you know, has always worked in the healthcare sector. So in the UK, her clients were really NHS and sort of all healthcare related clients. And then she came back to India and also worked with healthcare clients, but set up the public health practice. Now, around the time that she was in London, we talked, okay, let's do this. We had some very scandalous business ideas also. I cannot say on your podcast.
No, you can. Don't worry. There is no censorship here.
So actually, our first business idea was that we wanted to start a sex toys business. You definitely probably want to edit that. But
No, don't worry.
And, you know, I took like 12 hours to be like, that's fully illegal and we're not going to do that.
Illegal in the UK, not in the UK,
no,
right?
No, in India, it was fully illegal. Oh, it is still illegal.
You wanted to do a business in India?
Yeah, it was just a joke. It didn't last for longer than like 1 minute, right? But there still is no one, because you walk down the high street in London and you're like, there are 3 shops doing this, basically. And there are 0 shops doing this in India. So it was like, hey, abhi tak nahi hai, what's up? And we saw, it was started because there was this friend who was doing really nicely a lingerie business as well with it. Okay. That was like the first one. Then there were like, you know, the other thing we noticed was an absolute lack of like avocados in India at the time and good Mexican food. And, you know, looking at how sort of Chipotle had scaled with like restaurant business, but I feel restaurant businesses are extremely exhausting to get into. And to be honest, this was happening to me because I was also at Virgin, and that was like an ideas factory where every day you literally are on the board of or evaluating one mad idea after the other, right?
What was your role at Virgin?
So I was a corporate finance manager, and I reported to the CEO and CFO, and it was the part of Virgin which basically managed all of Richard Branson's assets. Okay. So he essentially, it is his portfolio and managing his ownership in the company. So it was really sort of a nice place to be, right? Because there was everything from, he'd set up a business of 7 bikers to get to the airport faster. That was called Virgin Limo Bike. Then there was like, you know, Virgin, I don't know, one day he had an idea, he wanted to go to the bottom of the Mariana Trench, which is the deepest part of the ocean. The next day you were like, how does Virgin Galactic get financing? Then the project we spent a lot of time was on Northern Rock, where Virgin bought a British bank after the crisis. Different things. Virgin basically owned a bunch of gyms in South Africa and in the UK called Virgin Active. So, you know, I was on the board of a company called Virgin Gaming, which was a poker site that they had. So I think what it meant was just every day there was like a different business or a business model, and I saw different types of leadership, different teams. So never really far. And I gotta be honest, I think that what happened for me was that JP Morgan was like, everything had 7 zeros, right? Virgin was a bit more real. They were not billions, but they were still hundreds of thousands and millions. And I was missing a little bit the, like, just starting from scratch and seeing things in a simpler realm and being able to affect change. It was also a time where you, in your career, you kind of have learned the sort of skills, early skill sets of doing stuff, and you're questioning yourself, saying, what impact am I actually having, right? Day by day, it's just like more zeros, more zeros. Sometimes I have to look at the Excel files and be like, or zeros, you know, like you're multiplying rows and columns. And it really, genuinely, I'm paraphrasing now, but it got to that. And then I just felt, I want to get my hands a bit dirtier. And that was the genesis of starting Slurp Farm, but I didn't realize quite how dirty or how difficult it was going to be.
So essentially, like, you were, again, something similar of what happened to you during your education, that the environment around you was all about startups and business ideas and setting up businesses.
Not
was kind
yet.
Of
yeah, as in that whole, the madness and frenzy around entrepreneurship startups had not started, but it was there in the company I was in, you know. I would say this whole, like, if you look at the arc of it, really the crisis has led to all this liquidity being available to startups, and therefore, you know, businesses being called entrepreneurship, that whole paradigm, almost cultural shift, right?
How has the crisis led to it?
How did the crisis lead to it? Okay, I'll give you, you want a short version or long version? I'll tell you the concise version of my theory of it, right? Basically, the crisis led to...
And you're talking about the Lehman crisis, just to clarify.
Yeah, I'm talking about the banking crisis, right? What
right.
I saw,
yeah.
So
yeah.
I made a very funny career move, which was that the... You know, June of that year, I decided that I was going to move to do investment, from investment banking M&A to leverage finance. Now, I didn't know that the whole world was going to go pear-shaped. My team of like 100 basically was down by almost 50%. But I had just moved to the team, but I survived being in the team as a new person. I'm also fairly junior, right? And I think it was great because I got to see the crisis from the leverage finance team. So when you understand debt and debt issuance, and really you almost, you know, I always did consumer healthcare M&A where you're advising companies what to buy, right? Leverage finance was that, is your core business sustainable enough to take on this debt? So you really get into the fundamentals of different businesses across different sectors. And then what followed soon after was that the team got into restructuring and infrastructure financing. Now, why very quickly and loosely I feel the crisis has led to this capital implosion is that what all the developed economies, the EU, UK, and the US did was quantitative easing, right? By pumping lots of cash back into the economy. That money has eventually landed itself, you know, it's not necessarily made its way down to the poorest person. It's basically landed in the hands of very wealthy individuals and institutions, all of whom are now investing in the sort of startup arena, right? Chasing return. That's the short version. You can go into the details and nuance of it. But essentially, all that helicopter money of QE is slowly now making its way back from startups to like getting 50% discount on Amazon, is broadly what I see happening. And so in the end, the consumer wins. So that cash comes back into the economy. How long is this sort of trend sustainable? You know, there's a lot of liquidity. What happens to asset prices? So many interesting questions. But I think that it is possibly one of those unintended consequences.
Okay. So coming back to how the journey to Slurp Farm happened, like, so you were in Virgin where there were like businesses that were getting set up, and you were on the board of a lot of them and learning about different types of businesses, different colors and flavors and sizes and so on. So how did that lead to Slurp Farm happening?
Around the same time, like I didn't have kids, and Meghna had just about, like, Nandita was, you know, she was pregnant with Nandita. And a lot of our friends started asking us, saying, bring back food for my child. And I remember talking to Nandita, Meghna, and saying, this makes no sense, right? Like, why are we doing this? India grows so much food. It didn't clock up. And then once Nandita was born, and we had been talking a little bit about this, and it was like, there really were no options. If you think about it, Akshay, from the time that you were a child to now, the choice on the shelf for what a baby or a child eats is pretty much the same. So there are two nuances to it. One is for the baby section, nothing has changed. Two is for the category sort of definition, right, of food for children, say under 10 years old. It has been created in all developed countries and is slowly getting created in India. Our realization down the road, and we thought it would happen, it's now starting to happen in India, was that that shelf would get created. But, you know, on today's date, there is a dog food shelf at major retailers, but there's no children's food shelf yet. And that's coming. So it has, that categorization or depth of category has happened in personal care, in clothing, in education, in all other fronts. So it literally is just a move, right, towards a more developed economy, towards, as people have more disposable income and less time, consuming more packaged food, looking for better alternatives within the packaged food space. So you could see that had played out in the UK and the EU. And actually, that's why it's the idea that stuck, because it was very close to what Meghna was doing work-wise. And she had by then moved back to India. And actually, she worked on the Bihar project, many different things. And she was like, I'm seeing these malnutrition statistics and they are really odd. And we read them so much, so we're a bit inured to them. But the fact that one in every three or four children in India is malnourished, not just because they are poor, but because they have either got, you know, obesity, diabetes. So both ends of the spectrum is not okay. It's really not okay. And so it felt somewhere, you know, I was telling you the whole theory of zeros thing, right? I was tired of seeing zeros. I also, and so did Meghna, the reason we love working with each other is that one of the first things she ever said to me, I will never forget, is that we're going to make a really super successful business and then use the money to work at the bottom of the pyramid, right? So while by no means are we running a sort of, you know, social sector organization, it's very much a for-profit company, I think that it is incumbent on us to solve that larger problem eventually, because I now feel, I was telling Meghna, I have learned so much that it can really, really, really be deployed and be used to solve sort of greater nutrition challenges. And I feel that that really was the sort of thing that nailed it for us, that where will I make an impact? Where will I make a difference, right? If I can change for the better how X million children eat, it's a great outcome. And we really, really need it right now. It's gotten out of control. Our children are eating way too much sugar. And I'll give you a simple anecdote. Like when I started, I asked my grandmother about what were their eating habits like. And amongst the things she said that is always embedded in my memory, right? She said, of course we ate dessert, but we ate it once or twice a week. And, you know, compare that to what's happening in our homes or this almost sort of every day there's a dessert, every day there's sugar. I'm talking about sugar, but there's also refined flour, maida, you know, trans fat in our food. It's just in the last 40 years, we have irreversibly changed how we eat and it needs to change back.
Did you have such a grand vision at that time when you were starting up? Or was it like, you know, small steps which eventually led you to where you are today in terms of a grander vision?
I think that, so when you say grand vision, do you mean wanting to affect change?
Yeah, like a big picture approach and saying, okay, this is a problem. Let's in India about
always,
millions of people.
And, if you go back to what Meghna and I have written in 2015, it's stayed consistent. I think that the how became clearer. So okay. I'll tell you what that means, right? Like, when we started, I had actually already had like the first, I wouldn't call it health crisis, right? But I would say health awakening. which was that I really at some point like started reading more about diet, and I was starting to, you know, many little things, like I had a, what do you call, like pre-diabetes, like that. All those indicators and markers from working too much, and you know, a life where you don't prioritize or think about your diet. And I started reading this writer called Michael Pollan, and then that led to like reading lots more. Really, I feel somewhere it's been a PhD of nutrition reading. But in that journey, what was very clear was that both two things. One is that the supermarket has a lot of options you shouldn't be eating at all. So, for example, the first time I understood baby food was that because I started eating a lot of those kids' food pouches for breakfast, because they're really super healthy. They don't have sugar in them. They have nothing additive, no preservative. If you're in a hurry, they're really, really easy. And they had oats and different fruits in the UK. It's a super quick meal, right? If you're really like that time-pressed, lazy person who doesn't want to spend 15 minutes making oats. That was the first thing, that the supermarket has a lot of options. The second thing was that the supermarket and companies have also solved for the problem. That packaging and advancements allow you to make products that are as good as what you eat at home, but the consumer is addicted to the wrong thing. So you have to both educate and provide a better alternative. So that, I would say, was pretty clear. I think the how became clearer over time, because in the beginning, we actually wanted to launch a vegetable and fruit puree product in India.
The so, kind that you see in Western markets in the supermarket.
Yes. And there were two really, this is why market research is so, so, so important. We had figured a way to make it in the UK. To be honest, we'd even found the machinery to say we'll come to India and bring that machinery to India, all of that, right, Akshay? And two things happened. One is the pound became very expensive against the rupee just that year in like 2014, 15. So you realize that you should actually fundamentally never start a business which is exposed to FX risk. That was one. The second thing was that...
But your idea was just to buy the machine in the UK and get it to India, right?
So in the beginning, we were before we got into manufacturing, our plan was to import, right? The first prototype and see if it works and then invest in the machinery.
And you had already quit your job by the time you were going through these plans.
I had, and Meghna had not. We were still thinking this through, but I had, to be honest, like in the UK, to make a prototype takes you 4 months. Right? In India, it takes a lot longer sometimes. But it was like, okay, done, finished, branding done. We can launch this product. But the consumer research was telling us really different things. One was that people didn't want fruit and veg purees. They only wanted them when they travel, which is not a big enough segment, right? You're making food for the 10 days a year that people are out. Like, that's not great. The second thing is that Indians, you know, eat fresh food, which is better. So why are you habit changing? Really, the point of where the pain point really was and where there was absolute lack of representation. And this is something Meghna realized when she had her daughter, is that we're not eating all of the things that we grew up eating in our own home. So there are no millets in the cereals for children. And there are now, okay? But at that time, there were none. There are no whole grains. Everything is highly refined, highly processed. And cereals make up 40% of your food, right? And so fruit and vegetable will be another sort of 30%. We were going after one bucket, but realized the need lay in the other. Right? And the interesting thing was that you have the dream and the vision, but you realize the answer is your grandmother's kitchen. That is, I think, the change in the journey of what was odd and what we didn't expect was to learn that. So I remember Meghna, when she had Nadita, and Nadita used to have this ragi cereal and porridge, she was like, this is awesome. We should do something and make something like what my grandmother is making for Nadita. And we should make other yummy things with ragi. But she was like, I have awful childhood memories of being forced to eat ragi. Can we just make it yummy? So then started that journey of trying to make ragi yummy. So, you know, I went back to a childhood friend from school, and she made the first Slurp Farm ragi cookies. and okay. they were delicious. They were so, but it took us 12 months to get a prototype, you know, of a cookie, and we had to use 5% maida. You could make a 0% maida cookie, but you know, in the doing the process of that, we met and saw so many factories, so many types of people, what kind of cookie
in India.
Yeah, drop machine, this machine, that machine. You actually, to be honest, I cannot eat out in most spaces and places after seeing how food actually gets made. So I cannot eat cookies off the shelf anymore. And I don't like to eat at weddings and on, you know, those. So like there's certain things that you realize the back end of the food industry really needs an overhaul.
So you like you quit your job and like came to India and like sustained on your savings, or like what was going on at this time? Like,
so to be honest, both of I would say that Slurp Farm was the journey of both of our savings of our sort of 20s and early 30s went into funding Slurp Farm at the start. We definitely couldn't have done it without, you know, some savings, and also both our husbands didn't quit their jobs. So I moved to the UAE because my husband got a job here, and Meghna moved to India because she was already working at McKinsey, and we started this. I would go back and forth to Delhi, which is where my parents are from. And the whole sort of, I would say the first sort of 2 years we were figuring it out, right? Because we had, actually we sort of, I quit with the prototype of that puree ready. I didn't expect it to not, for the market research to show that. So it probably took us another year and a half to work through what the first product should actually be. And I'm glad we did that. At the time, it was extremely sort of painful. And actually, in 2016, I want to say, the very first investor we did meet was Fireside, was Kaval, who saw the first cereal, and he's like, this is great. And we were too young and we were not ready to take on any institution at that point. So we were like, we're not, you know, we're still okay right now. Like, we were still bootstrapping it, still getting the product right. I would say that that sort of, I want to get the product right, has been this North Star in some way, I want to say. And I don't think, we're still working on it. I feel like 25 products in, I'm really excited about this year because I feel like the best of product development is yet to come. And we remember one thing, neither Meghna nor I had any background in food manufacturing, nor anybody to guide us and tell us, here's the shortcuts. So I think we kissed a lot of frogs. I cannot tell you the number of people we met who said, make a layer cake, make this kind of cookie, make, you know, just basically make versions of the same old thing you see. Very difficult. I'll give you an example. It was extremely challenging to find a biscuit vendor who would be willing on scale, because we found people who were doing handmade cookies, but that meant that, you know, you asked, was the vision always so grand? It was, because it was like, oh my God, I can't scale this, and it's really not exciting if I can't do it at scale. Want to do it. So, but then we went to the opposite end, right? We worked with someone who basically is a manufacturer for all the large cookie brands.
Okay.
And we did it too early, I would say, in hindsight. It was a 180-foot oven. It basically made, you know, 500 tons of cookies a day. So our production run was done in like an hour, and it was not the most efficient way to start. You learn these things. So sometimes actually what happens is when you start with the mad vision, you solve for the mad vision, and then you realize that, like, slow down, build your brand, and then and then get to the mad vision, you know.
But like the manufacturer, how did he agree to, like, you know, take this bet in a way? Was it like purely a commercial transaction, or was there a certain amount of convincing which you needed to do?
So the two manufacturers who worked with us, you know, our first two manufacturers, I would say, were our first VCs.
In
that, God bless them. They had no earthly commercial reason to work with us at the time. apart from like just a lot of tenacity and energy and conviction and convincing. And, you know, we found also in both cases someone who knew both manufacturers in common, went there, spoke, spent a lot of time in remote factories, both of them. And I would say in both instances, you know, I would say two founders who also maybe just said, yeah, let's do this. It definitely was not for the money for either of them to start with.
Right.
I don't know. I like, you know, so many times, Akshay, and we were talking, people say, was it difficult being a woman entrepreneur, all that, right? I don't think that anybody ever asked that question. So I feel, and I want to tell you this or other people this, that if you really just say, I'm going to do this, and it'll come across in your meeting, right? And then you'll find somebody with the same energy and sort of kindred spirit. So the interesting thing is actually the first person that we worked with was in Jaipur. And it's called, it's a company called Down to Earth, which was one of the first organic food brands of India. And at the time, we wanted to be a 100% organic brand. And then we realized that the market demand is organic for some things, which is what we are. And it's not organic for all things. So when we worked with them, their process was all very handmade. And so we had to move sort of halfway in because we felt we couldn't scale that. But had a wonderful relationship, really, really fond of them. And the thing that really actually made my day is that the CEO of that company called Meghna after our last fundraise to say, you know, he told us something that time. He said, ye jo hai na, aapko pehli meeting pe, I'll say it in English, no one will tell you all the answers in the first meeting. You go second, third, it's like unpeeling an onion. You won't learn all the knowledge on day one. You have to get there slowly, slowly, slowly. And at the end, you'll know all the answers. And he was right. But it was great because he called her to say, you know, and this is 6 years on, like that, wow, yay, I'm happy for you. So I would say in each case, right, there was someone like that who was an early cheerleader.
So how did the actual launch happen? Like you spent 2 years in figuring out, you kept trying and researching and pivoting, and eventually you found these manufacturers who were ready to make the product you finalized, which was a millet-based cookie. So from there, tell me about how like the commercial part of Slurp Farm started, you know, in terms of commercializing this product and taking it out to the market and, you know.
Yeah, I'd love to talk to you about that. So firstly, I'll tell you two things. One is about the launch, and then the second is about thinking through go-to-market strategy, right? So in terms of the launch, and this is to anyone who started a business in today's time, you have no idea how fortunate you are, because we started in 2016 where there was no GST. So of course, at the one, there were three amazing things that happened around that 2016-17 time, which were good for small new businesses like ours. One was GST itself happened. But before that, there was Amazon and Big Basket were really picking up. And the third thing that then helped us was demonetization. Okay. And I'll talk through all three of them. So our first sort of portals of launch were stores in Delhi. And, you know, remember that we are, so as a company, we are registered in Delhi. So we were selling in stores in Delhi. And it was even challenging at that point to sell in a store in Noida or Gurgaon, because you have to get a C form to cross the border if you wanted to do your business legitimately, right? So forget going to Bombay to go to Gurgaon, right? And then we also did online. So we launched on Amazon and Big Basket, and Amazon had just started grocery, and that was really, really exciting. And I still remember the first time Meghna's grandmother packed all the boxes. You know, she and I drove to the warehouse to deposit our boxes, and you were watching every single sale. And then I was like, my own father is buying the first 10 cookies. Can he stop? All that. So it was funny. Because that was how Slurp Farm started. We were in a lot of retail stores in Delhi. So, you know, you'd hear and it was word of mouth. And I think it really started to pick up when it went beyond people you know who buy your product, right? That's when
we moved
to the next realm. We went to a lot of schools. We did a lot of sampling at play areas and schools and events and fairs and pop-ups and what have you. Then came GST, which was a game changer. Really, like, it just made it possible for young companies to trade in India as if it is one country and removed all these barriers to, like, big companies were set up, right? And they had warehouses and they had these CNF agents in every state. So they were set up with the understanding of how to navigate that. And we were just getting to it and it just all fell apart. So between Amazon and this entire sort of overhaul, basically, you could reach a consumer in any part of India from the time that you launch. It's inconceivable now that it was anything but it was not. Right? And that's why I would say our early DNA was like, hame to offline build karna hai. We have to go the store route.
And well, you had no choice at that time.
We had no choice. And I would say that was the wrong choice and the wrong DNA. But we were just saying, okay, want to scale, have to. And even now, you can't grow unless you grow in the store network, okay? But you have an alternative.
Yeah, I mean, that's how I also discovered Slurp Farm. Like, yeah. The first time I saw it was in a store only.
Cool. I didn't know that. Where?
Noida.
Okay. Happy something worked. But I mean, I fundamentally believe in the end, we will have to be offline focused, okay? That's where you get volume. And people still, I enjoy going to the store to shop. So that's not going away. It's just that COVID, I mean, has added another dimension. And anyway, so later in 2016-17, right, with demonetization, it basically really made it a level playing field. Because there was no more, and we actually used to have the ulta problem, right? People used to be like, give us cash. And we'd be like, oh man, we have to go to the bank and remove cash from the bank. So how do I do that? That was always a pain. I have not had to deal with that at all since. And that's it. For newer age businesses, it's just, it's made the ease of doing business go up to what it should be and is in other parts of the world. And so that was the sort of how we started. Then in terms of go-to-market, our initial emphasis was on building this big offline sort of network, I would say. And that I would say was the biggest learning of Meghna in my life in some sense. Because the thing that people don't say, right, you come from these very corporate jobs, McKinsey, JP Morgan, all that. And then you have to go and build a sales force, which is motivated entirely differently to anything you have been exposed to or used to.
Right.
And we started in Delhi. Then we tried to do in Bangalore and Bombay. I even moved to Bangalore for 6 months to try to set up an offline sales force there. And I just, you know, if I were to be honest, I failed at it.
Okay.
On a grand scale. I had no understanding of how to do this, but I did visit 200 stores all over Bangalore. That was probably the one positive point. I got to spend time with my mother, who was also there for that duration of time. So it was nice. But I would say that there was a very challenging 18-month period of the journey of Slurp Farm where we tried to grow offline. And it sucks cash. And the issue is that no one pays you cash.
Okay.
No one pays you back. I would sometimes tell Meghna, this is ridiculous. And, you know, my husband used to laugh at me because he'd be like, your Sundays, you're only calling people to be like, aapko mujhe 5,000 rupay wapis dene hai. That was my Sunday. And we would literally be sending someone once, twice, thrice. So the cost of getting your money back was probably equivalent to what that person was paying you. And I think that until, you know, COVID has made things so much clearer. But having said that, what trying to build offline taught us is A, how the system works. So, you know, when we go back to it, we will understand it. B, I think it taught us, we did a lot of offline events. So we used to have a calendar across, we basically went and hired an offline events team. And we never outsourced this to third parties because you felt it is always best in-house. And literally, I think we had some of the most amazing mums of India, all of whom called us up and said, I really believe in what you're doing. I want to join you. So our events team in Bangalore had Sakshi. And you know, in Bombay, we had Shraddha, who also heads our online business, but would do events. And in Delhi, it was the whole team. There was Vaishali and Pankhuri and, you know, the rest of the whole office. And I would say that at one point, we were doing 4 to 5 events a week. And by that, I mean, you know, all these children's events or mommy pop-ups. I don't know if you're ever into that world, but they're incredibly powerful sources of discovery of brands.
Okay. I've never attended one of these type of events.
If I'm really honest, I don't think I would have, but for Slurp Farm. And but it is incredible because, you know, people when they have young children want to find ways to buy products, and it's lots of these events exist. And we find out and we did them.
These are like a slightly more like for well-to-do audience, or is it like a mela in a park type of a thing, or is it a event in a mall?
So you'll have the more high-end ones, which are often in hotels. Then you'll have the more mass ones, which will be in, you know, an entertainment space or a big wide open park or open to everybody. Then you have those that are in a mall. And I really miss them because I was counting with Meghna, both she and I used to do 30, 40 a year. And I have done them in Hyderabad, in Chennai, in Kochi, in Bangalore, in Delhi, in Bombay, because they're the best way for you to keep speaking to your consumer, right? To understand what are they saying, how do they buy, what gets through.
So you'd be like giving out samples of your cookies and...
Yeah, like selling at a stall. Selling at a stall.
Okay. And also directing them, like buy this from Amazon or something like that.
Correct.
Okay. And at the same time, you would get feedback and like understand what are their needs and things like that.
Correct. And it's such a nice direct way of doing it, right? Like people, you're standing there and no one cares like whether you're the mom who started the company or not. They'll just tell you what they think. And it's the most honest, amazing feedback. So we did a lot of that. We did a lot of store selling. We did a lot of feedback getting. It made us change our products a lot. We, you know, kept refining the product. And I think along the way... we wanted to do a website. So we did. We launched our own website. And I must say, it took us, I don't know, like close to what, 14 months to get a website up. That's how little Meghna and I understood digital when we started.
But why 14 months? I mean, like, you could have got a vendor to give you something in a couple of weeks.
I think that you learn, right, along the way, many things. I'm just going to put it down to that. So I would say that you also learn. Like, I mean, you could, today I can tell you, I can make you a cookie product in 2 months. I can make your website now in 2 months, but that was not the case then. So I think, it, you know, everything takes its journey. You maybe sometimes identify the wrong vendor, right? Who themselves doesn't know how to build a website. Right. So all of that happened. And I think what, at the end of it, right, we were sort of, COVID was a pivotal point, if I jump the story a little bit. In that, our first fundraise was a very much friends and family fundraise.
Which year was that first fundraise?
2018.
Okay.
This was actually a really fun moment in itself. Every single person had either called us off the back of an envelope, the packaging, right?
Packaging, yeah. Wow.
Literally, two people called the consumer helpline. Or there were people who were friends or family and loved the product and had said, when you raise, please call me. So, you know, and I was pregnant, 6 months pregnant during my fundraise. It never came up. It closed in 2 months. It was a very not a lot of like conversation kind of fundraise. And it really, to us, was like the sort of, gave us the ability to experiment at offline in that time.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
and then sort of get that website up, never realize how important it would be, because I still feel that the e-commerce portals are a very important part of food, especially. And that's because you might go to a website to buy clothes, but your food you still buy as part of your bigger basket. So you might do it for your child when they're very young, but over time, basically, khane ke time pe, like, you know, you buy, do all your shopping in one go. You don't always take the time. I'd go buy my sort of running trainers maybe on a D2C website. So the jury's still out there, right? And I feel like the world is going to move to digital and we have to engage with all platforms of digital. But what happened in the first 3 months, COVID hit and, you know, we had nothing and no one who was willing to place an order with us in those first 3 months. Maybe many people have said this to you in the course of your podcasts. I don't know what your experience has been with others, but March, April was very scary times.
Okay. No, so I've spoken to people from other categories, like PSafe, for example, saw a spurt in orders, but then their product is different, you know. So
we saw a massive spurt in orders after the lockdown ended.
Okay. So initially, there was a fear of contamination, so people were afraid to order anything from outside at all, I guess.
Correct. So March, April, what happened was that we essentially saw, you know, lockdown happened, Amazon Big Basket stopped placing orders of anything, stores stopped paying vendors. There was a lot of that was happening. There was just chaos in the market. Then when the...
What kind of monthly run rate are you at before COVID hit, like the monthly top line?
Our monthly run rate, you know, I can share a few numbers. Before COVID was sort of at around 40 lakhs, 50 lakhs a month. It is now closer to the 1.2 crores a month number.
Wow.
And that jump happened, I would say, because of embracing digital in a bigger way. But equally that, you know what the interesting thing is? It's also simpler, right? It's that when you are going in a store, if a new brand doesn't have shelf space, they'll never get seen. Whereas now that most people have switched to shopping digital, you search for a brand you might have seen or you'll see an ad and you'll buy it. So it's easier to get discovered and then hopefully build long-term resonance. So I would definitely say COVID helped us grow hugely, hugely. But in the early days, it was very scary. And for, you know, for some of the other brands that you may have spoken to, which are digital, they didn't have to make a business change. We had to make a business change. We basically had to cut out our entire offline business.
What percentage was offline, like in Jan-Feb?
It was 50% of it, right? And it has not really grown since then. So, and in fact, it has degrown, and we just have decided that we are, until this whole situation calms down, going to focus big time on digital. Also because you get paid upfront or on time, one of the two, right? On your website, you get paid before you ship. On Marketplace, you get paid within 30 days. That is not the case with traditional retail. And it's very challenging to manage that.
But you would be working with like a... like an agency that would further supply to retail, so that agency would pay you. Like, is that how it happens? Like, in terms of offline retail?
No, you work with a distributor, and we worked with many distributors directly. Of course, you can also work with like a, you know, more meta distributor. So basically, there'll be one guy who aggregates other distributors. We didn't do that model yet, and to be honest, like at the start, it is hard for new brands to do that because you have to build some market recognition. And
you won't get shelf space. Like your product will just be languishing somewhere.
No. We also did a PhD almost on like shelf, in-store shelf collateral, right? So right from how do you appear visible to the tape, to the sticker, to the, I mean, all kinds of merchandising I had never heard of or thought of or realized that anyone was deploying on me.
Okay.
You go in the store. Okay. I don't look. I never thought so hard on intent of being an in-store shopper. Mm. So, and think about it, to someone who's basically your grocery buying experience becomes like 20x more nuanced. I walk into a grocery store now, I can spend hours. And it's not just about food, but like, I will notice everything.
Your packaging.
Yeah, other people's packaging, sampling, merchandising, what's going on. I really, really enjoy it.
So what has been the, you were telling me about the funding journey. Like in 2018, you had a friends and family round, which you closed in 2 months without much of a challenge in that. So from that to now, when you have Fireside as a backer, how did that happen?
So I would say Fireside is the first fund that we ever spoke to. And we didn't really do a lot of pitches as such. At some point, like the second fundraise happened fairly easily. And it took us sort of about 2 years to run through that cash. Actually, when COVID hit, we had just about started to fundraise. And COVID happened and we ran out of cash, basically, because when no one pays you, you burn cash twice as fast, right?
Right, so right.
If you're burning whatever, X a month, you start to burn 2X, 3X because no money is coming back.
There's no incoming.
Yeah. Plus, we saw that there's going to be a spike, but then you need money to invest in inventory. Then you have no money for marketing. So it was like many things hit you all at once. So actually, we were at that point where Meghna and I put money back in the business because we just thought it's going to be so hard to fundraise right now in the middle of COVID, not a great time. And the interesting thing that happened, Akshay, is that we turned P&L positive. So, you know, cash flow positive takes you time because you have debts and debtors who haven't paid you and employees who you had to cut a business outright. We cut our offline business, so you have to pay people. But on a P&L basis, we turned positive.
Which month?
From June onwards. So April, May was very scary. June onwards, we started to, like, because you're forced to operate in discipline. So we stopped making all the products that didn't make money. We stopped shipping, like, puff pouches. We stopped making our cookies, which we were not breaking even on because they were real butter cookies. And, you know, that doesn't make you money unless you sell them for a lot more money. We stopped working with any vendor who didn't pay us on time.
Okay.
I would say things that you're scared to do in good times and you feel like you must do them to grow a business. All of that just came down to, sorry, I don't have the cash to do this. And I cannot, you know, I had a friend who's a dear mentor. He sat me down and he said, okay, if you have to run this company with just you and Meghna, can you do it? It came to that, right? Then one person, then two people, then three people, then four people. So you really start to think about what you've built something and what is essential. I think that discipline really, really, really helped us. And you realize that even when you're running a very, very tight show, there are layers of fat you can cut. Which is what got us to break even. And then our revenue started to grow because of greater digital adoption, because we started to do, like, Umang, who's the third co-founder, started to really, really, I mean, I would say from a marketing branding perspective, the brand has really grown up and come into its own. And he's all of that, right? And he's built a team. And interestingly, we don't have a team anymore. We don't have a physical office. We shut it in March, April, I want to say, because we were like, this is not ending. And has moved to Goa from Delhi.
Wow.
And now I would say the most number of people working in an office at Slurp Farm are in Goa. So I keep joking and telling him that if I had known that the place where you live would become so important to the company, I would have asked him to not live in such a remote village, because you walk out of his house and there is a gaon outside and that's where the office is, because he's rented another apartment in the same building, which is the Slurp Farm office. But that's what COVID has meant. Everybody's remote. And completely different company. I'm very sorry, but in the like enjoying our conversation, I've forgotten what you asked me. I suspect you have
the funding. So you told me you became PNL positive, and
okay, sorry. So in the middle of that, Meghna got a message from Fireside, and I will tell you something funny about Meghna, which she will kill me for saying. But she basically is like, if someone like who's the analyst on the team at a fund messages me, I don't respond because she's like, mere paas itna time nahi hai, I don't see my kids, right? So she doesn't, she's like, I don't have time to spend with my daughter. You don't have time to spend with your kids. So if a very young child is messaging me, I'll just not want to reply.
So
it was a very young child and she didn't reply. So then someone more grown up called her and she took the call. It was a great conversation. But, you know, I used to laugh at her, but I have realized one thing. She's right, because you need to conserve your energy, right? You could waste a lot of time. We don't waste that much energy on fundraising conversations. And I would say maybe that changes as you grow business. But that was it. We had a conversation. We had met 4 years ago. So it was really nice. It was, you know, even from the Fireside end, they said, you know, this is the first time we're funding without doing a in-person meeting.
Wow.
But we had met many times in 2016. And it's really nice. It feels almost, I was telling Meghna, maybe sometimes, you know, you're meant to do something and the timing is just off.
So this was like an inbound inquiry of funding, which is pretty amazing, and especially given that it was probably amongst the toughest times for most startups.
Yeah, but you know, if you look back at 2020 in hindsight, right, any brand that was sort of able to grow in that did so. It was also a good time. So it was a very tough year and it ended on a good note, and we're very excited about 2021 because on the one hand, it's really nice to have an institution which really just gets the market. And I think if I were to share one piece of advice for anyone who's listening this long into the conversation, it is that, it is that when you start, you do not understand the benefit that an institutional investor does bring. And a lot of that, depending, you know, hoping you have to make the right choice of person and team and vision, and it has to match. It really has to match. Fundamentally, it has to match. But when it does, it's great because you now have another partner sounding board for all of your sort of thinking and vision for growing. It's great. And I would say we've been really lucky because a lot of our early investors were like that.
As in they were bringing in more than just money.
Yes, and we took people who, to be honest, we could have done a far bigger fundraise even then. And people wanted to give more money, but we wanted people's intellect over money. So every person contributed something. There's 13 people, so I can't do justice to all of them. I don't want to say, you know, go individually, but like there are people who have given us time by being in the office for days on end and sitting with the team and thinking through org structure and really pulling their weight behind that. I would say there were others who are founders themselves who, whenever I need help choosing like an agency or thinking through something creative and marketing related, have been great. There are people who, one of them, you know, when I was in London, spent a lot of time talking to me, just, this was in sort of 2017, 2018, saying, go digital now, all the time, right?
Okay.
And was like, have you seen Bonobo? Have you seen Warby Parker? And I was like, I have no idea what that is. And this, you know, they're all US businesses. So didn't really, really live in that San Francisco vibe either. So that was really useful. I can't, like literally everybody added something, right? Right, from someone who helped us with logistics to someone who helped us think through other fundraising conversations to people who read pitch decks and pitch books. I think that it's at the end of it, it's been a very nice sort of, you have that first round, which is like your friends and family that you can always cry on their shoulders a bit. And then next round, which is really the institution which brings the the force of taking your vision to where you want to take it.
Right, right.
Mm. And in the course of that, you kind of also pivot your product, perfect your product, right? That's also important. That's also important because your first day product is not all, like, it needs a lot of help, and you're not willing to see that as an entrepreneur sometimes.
Which is what I want to ask you next about the product journey. Like, you started with cookies. Tell us about the journey from cookies to what all you do today.
So, you know, I was making a matrix of things, like learning journeys. So I would definitely say cookies and offline was in the why did you do that box.
Okay. Okay.
And I remember thinking,
why is that?
Because, like, the cookies were never unit positive.
Oh, okay.
And that's because of the scale of manufacturing, actually. Like, if we were to run the full day of the factory, we would have made money, but we were not able to scale to that run size.
So essentially, it's a demand issue then. Right? There was not, like, a large enough demand.
No one can generate 400 tons of demand on day one. So maybe in like 2 years time, I should go back to that. But it was like thoda aage sochna, because you want to make a, you know, I think what happens very honestly is there was Meghna and Saurabhi thinking everything at scale, right? The advice you give your client is think at this like mad scale. So then you start to apply.
You had the JP Morgan mindset.
Yeah, basically. But it doesn't work because you're like sending your client an NDA on day one, and this is India, so they're laughing at you saying, what's wrong with you? Or you're like making these long agreements, and they're like, we don't sign agreements. So there was a lot of that. We made like QC manuals, so much stuff, right? And we were always trying to think, oh my God, you're going to get to like this. If you don't change a nutrition outcome for a large enough number of people, it just isn't exciting for both of us. So in terms of the product journey, we started with the cereals, actually. But we added the cookies because we felt, remember, we were thinking offline, that you would never be able to sample your product if you didn't have something that a customer can taste. So when you're sitting in the store, I can't just put the cereal on the shelf and then not be like, hey, I also have a cookie. Try it.
Right.
It's difficult to make a cereal and give it to a consumer. And even at an event, you get talking because someone tries your cookie. And it was a really yummy cookie. It was on AirAsia. We put it on a bunch of different sort of hotels and airlines. So even adults loved it. And then we sort of grew in that whole cereal space. So we had 3 to start with. Today we have almost 12. We really want to expand that space. I think the other thing we realized, you know, because I didn't have any kids when we started, and now I have 2. And I would say all of the repertoire of things that I fed my kids for breakfast, or Nandita, which is Meghna's daughter, was fed for breakfast, have made it to the list of things that Slurp Farm makes. So, you know, nut powder, which is like, there are 3 nuts and we put saffron in it, and it's something that our kids were given with their cereal, is a product we make. And it's really, 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 we try to do the best quality version of it, right? Or we sell a jaggery, which is what I prefer to use even for having chai at home. And it's a really nice jaggery. So it sells really well because once people buy it, they know it's hard to find that.
Okay.
We make sprouted ragi because that was not one of the things. We just make sprouted ragi by itself because it's such an amazing thing for children to eat. And again, in our house, we eat it, even rotis made with that.
So as in like a sprouted ragi powder, which can be used for anything, like an atta, basically.
Yeah, it can be used for atta or cereal, both. I would say that as we evolved, a lot of our own food eating habits entered the lexicon of the products we make. And then a lot of, in the beginning, our cereals were really, really, there was zero processing happening, right? So they were not instant. And people found that so hard that they started baking cakes with the baby cereal and making pancakes.
Okay.
And we were like, shit, firstly, we need to fix the product. But why don't we make pancakes and dosa anyway? So, because it's the second thing a child eats after a cereal, you know, like, you have children. So a lot of this sort of baby-led weaning culture started. And children eat real food much younger, which is great. So we started making millet dosas and millet pancakes. And again, it was like a...
Which is how I discovered Slurp Farm, through through the beetroot and the palak dosas.
I'm so happy. And there's always that confusion now, right? Because a lot of adults like it, and somehow the packaging makes adults feel like they can't eat it. And I would say that is the core dilemma that sometimes Umang, Meghna and I grapple with, in that if you had something which was more adult looking, it would be lost as a brand. You would not stand out with that sort of fun and creativity and that, I don't know, the branding which we all enjoy, actually. And a lot has gone into the branding. I can talk to you a little bit about that. Adults can eat it, but kids love it. And I actually think that the reason we have stuck with the child space is that people make habit change with their children first. And children are always the first starting point, right? Like, no firecrackers started with children, or even so many environmental concerns, they start with children. And this return to eating healthy is going to start with our kids. And I actually think after return to eating healthy, it'll be like stop using your mobile device will start with our kids. So
then, probably things like privacy, yeah. You know, all that stuff. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Mm. Yeah, but more so, even my child already tells me, "Mommy, get off your phone." Like,
yeah, yeah.
So they really get it as kids. And I feel if I say one thing, and I was telling my mom the other day, when I was growing up and you were growing up, there was no conception that this is too much sugar. We didn't correlate. So, like, you know, I used to love to go to Bangalore for summer holidays because the bread there was sweeter. Now, I didn't think that the bread is sweeter because someone's putting sugar in it. I just thought milky bread. Like, you just didn't make that simple correlation. Why is the bread tastier? And it's probably not good for you because it's tastier. It just is tastier. So it was like eating cake, broadly. And I don't know if you know what I mean, but in Bangalore, the bread is like smaller and tastes very different to the way like a modern bread of Delhi will taste.
Okay. No, I'm not aware.
I mean, something like someone who spent a bit of time understands the distinction. But, you know, we were given nimbu pani with like 4 or 5 teaspoons of sugar, as much tang as you want. So we ate a very healthy diet of fruit and vegetable, but there was no control on the aspect of sugar because no one understood it. And dialing that back has to start with these kids. They just have to eat less of it. So we moved from doing cereals to pancake and dosa. Then we also made these puff snacks. And then again, every point as our kids grew older, we could see the need. We started making different products, right? And we were at a holiday in Coorg, and my son was like, "Mommy, can I have chocos? I've never had them in my life." And he never allow me. So I was like, of course, I felt really bad. And I said, yes. Meghna and I got talking after that. And I said, listen, you know, we should make something that is a better version. Then we started getting into a lot of superfoods that we felt children should eat. And we eat at home a lot. So right from a chia seed to eating this nut powder and the jaggery and the sprouted ragi, and to eating like an oat powder, brown rice powder, which you can use in different ways in your food. Then during COVID, our kids were baking a lot. So I was like, Megha, let's make some nice cake mixes because kids are sitting at home, and I would be, you know, working and literally next door in the kitchen, like a very unhealthy cake was getting baked every day. That started. Next, we're going to actually get into doing a lot of the core sort of millet itself and some flours. So
like atta, basically, yeah, you're saying?
If you
like
want to do atta, you want to make a pizza base or whatever you want to do with it, or you want to, whatever. You can go from atta to baking a cake to anything with it. And especially
like Kosh, I think I've seen Kosh as a brand which has that kind of, those different kinds of attas.
I have not seen that particular brand, but there are many people doing it.
I think it's a Big Bazaar brand or something. I only see it in Big Bazaar stores.
Okay, I'm going to check it out after. But it's, you know, so it, that's sort of been the evolution of the product journey. And it's really trying to address a child under 10 in every possible thing. We're also going to do a really awesome a drink, which we had made about 3 years ago, I want to say.
Okay.
And we always felt we are not going to launch this because how many, you know, that's a very defined space. But I feel now people have the awareness post-COVID to engage with an immunity drink or a daily milk mix-in. Really, it's a milk mix-in.
Okay. So it's like a Bonvita substitute.
Yes. yeah, lots of fun ideas of what's coming next.
What about a Maggie substitute? And this is me as a parent making a demand, you know, my kid
loves
Maggie.
Yeah, but you're so spot on. You're so spot on. It's there. Again, I'm going to send you after this really nice chat I've had with you. We had done the branding for like a fun range of millet noodles. I would say that we need to find a stable manufacturer of that product, and it has to be up to scratch.
Wow, I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, me too, actually. Like, it's like that one thing, no? It doesn't ever... Yeah. There's nothing like a bowl of noodles on a duff day.
Yeah. So, tell me about Umang. We didn't talk about how he became a co-founder.
So Umang has always been a co-founder. It's, we keep joking saying two mothers and a brother doesn't sound cool on the pack, so it says two mothers.
Okay. He's your brother?
No, he's my best friend to his, you know, displeasure since we were 4 or 5 years old. We've known each other. We went to school together. I've probably terrorized him much of my school years. And, when we started this, I called him and said, come on, let's do it. And I think he didn't know what he was getting into, is my sense. So he said yes.
What was he doing before he joined you?
He's a graphic designer and a video artist by training. I always get describing what he does wrong, so he's always cringing. he used to, you know, work in a graphic design firm started by his father. At the age of 31, 32, all of us sort of quit our jobs, him included, because he said, I never want to manage people again. Like, I just want to.
Okay.
Yeah. So he was very clear that I don't want to do that. And I, you know, at some part of him also wanted to be a full-time artist. And now he has really gotten into Ayurveda and studying the Vedas. So I am being sent a lot of material to read. But I would say Umang is the soul of Slurp Farm. Always has been. And
he's the creative mind behind the packaging design and all the characters on the design.
Yeah. And he sort of, the brand looks the way it does because of him. He also does all of the communication, you know, visual communication of the brand is all him. If I had a dollar for every time someone asked me for his number, I would be very rich. Literally, you'll be like, what is your packaging? Which company can I call them? And from all ages and stages and people have asked me this. And they don't sometimes believe me when I'm like, he doesn't do this as a job. Slurp Farm, I would say, is the only sort of graphic design and video communication project Umang has done in recent times, but he's worked with several very big brands. He has done projects for IDEO, but also for ITC for very long. I can't say because he's my oldest friend, but I think he's a genius. He has this way of seeing things with utter clarity that I wish I possessed. And Meghna and I are very lucky to have him.
When you asked him to join you, did you know that Slurp Farm will be a design first kind of a brand, and how pivotal his role would be, or it just happened to work out like that?
No, I think I always knew that, and it's always also been that by design, right? You can choose to do this without that. So there are many brands that are not design first, and they are very successful. So it's not to say that it's a core ingredient of what you ought to do. I would say it's a core ingredient of what brings us joy. That creative process, you can outsource it to an agency, but I really don't know if I'd have fun doing it. And there are several differences in points of opinion. And we debate them so openly. It's a lot of fun. And I would say, so everything has a lot of thought that goes into it. There are 7 animals in the Slurp Farm branding. They're all animals of India. So there's a rhinoceros, there's an elephant, there's a monkey, there's a tiger, there's a bear, there's a tota. So it was to choose these animals. And this year we're going to do what we have always dreamt of doing, which is bring these storybooks alive. Because I felt that for a brand to be also able to reach its, our consumer and customer are two different people. And really engage with the consumer. Like we also want to tell stories. I love storybooks, kids. So that was the intent probably 6 years ago, and it'll happen now. But it was always there. To do cookbooks was always there. So I would say there are many projects that have been brewing in our head. So when you asked, was that vision always there? Yeah, there was always a mad vision. There was always a design first love and thinking. And I think what was not there was the understanding of how much time it does take. See, you either have to have a lot of time or a lot of money, you know? Like, you have to short circuit by one.
Right, right. So you're going to create like storybooks featuring Slurp Farm characters.
Yeah.
And like
yeah.
get a publisher to launch them.
Yeah.
That's pretty amazing. I mean, I can imagine my kid getting excited about Slurp Farm, the food product, if he has read Slurp Farm books. I mean, you know, books with Slurp Farm characters. The way, like, if he sees anything which has Snoopy on it, he'll want to buy it, you know, irrespective. It's a chocolate or a
biscuit. Exactly
that.
Right? And, like, okay, if I have to ask you, what are some of your kids' favorite books? What are they?
Yeah, Peanuts, you know, like, that's... And Thomas the Train, like, that's what he's currently obsessing with.
Same. My child lived on Thomas. And I feel like there needs to be some of these iconic books for children which are Indian.
Right.
You know, we have so many of these stories and characters. Of course, yes, things like Thomas and Peppa have so much money thrown behind them also over time. But even some of the books that you will encounter as your children grow up that every child seems to have, there needs to be that Indian version of them, really.
Right.
Can
right.
And then we're really excited, right from your board book and your, you know, ABC book to your storytelling book to your just fun stories about eating, all of that. So let's see. That's 2021.
But I would imagine that an investor might wonder, because, you know, you're from an investment banking background and you know that, you know, that thesis on core competencies, and they might feel that why are you going outside of your core competency into an unrelated area? Like, did you face any pushback on that? Like, when you talked about this plan to make books?
It's not going outside our core competency. It exists within the team. The illustration, the putting together of the book, the person writing it. Is inherent to Slurp Farm today. And now that you're digital, actually what you do need is more things to sell on your website to the same customer. Between Amazon and my website, I have a CAC that I'm paying, like cost of customer acquisition for the ad to bring them to my site. Really the goal is I don't need 25 things, I need 100 things. And I need to do them as inventory light way as possible. So no, I mean, I think it is very much in sync with what the brand needs to do to establish. You know, if you take a 90-year view to things, none of these things seem like that scary.
Right.
I want to be where some of the big food brands are today. I might not be around. But you have to do all these things.
Inspiring. So what percentage of your sales comes from your own website as on date?
Just under a third.
Okay. And how do you like drive sales? Is it like Facebook ads and stuff like that?
Yeah. Ads, Instagram, Facebook. We also have a lot of repeat customers. The thing that works for all Indian consumers, discount. I think right now we're also in the phase where we are wanting more and more people to try. And so we do a sale every few months, not too often. It's more like a a way to say, see, either you'd be getting to a customer by sampling them, or you do some kind of discount-led strategy, and then now we're trying to do a mix of both, right? So for me also, I respond really well to this. When someone sends me a sample, I try the product and I like it, I use it every single day. There are a few products in my fridge today that are like that. So the power of sampling is huge.
Yeah, that's true. So Slurpfarm is like, you know, if I had to give it a label, then I would say like it's a D2C digital native brand. You know, what do you think that means, and especially in the context of India?
So I think that D2C is pretty much the acronym of the season, right? And while it is seen as, wow, something different to do, it really is about embracing a new medium to do the same thing that all other mediums do, right? Whether you're engaging with someone through a events-based or a gifting-based or an offline store paradigm, your online medium is helping you reach your customer. So it's a, you cannot put it in a bucket and say, I will do one and not the others eventually. But you can, I think what D2C has done has given brands the ability to do a very quick go-to-market, test product hypothesis, and then continue to build awareness and engagement digitally. And this is by the very fact that the infrastructure around this whole space, there's a really fun blog that I like a lot called basically Shopify's Arming the Rebels. And, you know, it's that there is the whole sort of infrastructure of the D2C space has come up across and grown up in India in the last, I would say, 2, 3, 4 years. And right from the platform where you will put your products on to the fact that there will be warehousing and logistics that you need to think of, to the sort of complexity of what is your consumer thinking of, right? They want, why do people shop online? They shop online because they perceive better prices and they want quick delivery. How do you make that happen? To how do you think at the core of it around building engagement with your customer? And, you know, is there an offline element to it and an online element to it? But all of this is possible for companies to do with less, I would say, money and less pain and headache as the offline channel gives you. So really, the big explosion of D2C has been in the plethora of people who are now also a part of this value chain. So right from, you know, earlier in the beginning, you may have had like a FedEx, and they may not have had the systems in place, but then now you have delivery, and delivery is geared towards helping startups and startup systems, and it's been great. It's the reason why we were able to get up on our feet again after COVID. Or the whole like world of warehousing and the whole world of, so when we talk about it, we only talk about the Facebook, Instagram and the funding, right? But there is like this bigger world behind making that machinery work. And it's really exciting because that machinery is coming alive in India now. So you will soon have almost a parallel system. So your marketplaces have built a system. Right? They have their own warehousing, own logistics, you supply them. But then you can also exist in your own ecosystem. So I think it's a very, very exciting sort of almost second way in the online space. And more than anything, I think, depending on the category you're in, so there are some categories where it's like, so I don't know if I'm selling a more commoditized product or something which is very much about make the sale, move on, right? But for brands like ours, it's also about a platform to tell your story. When someone comes to my site, they get a lot more information. They get to see videos. They get to see what's behind the brand. They get to see and learn a little bit more and get a sense of that thing. And at the end of the day, we might say human beings don't respond to branding, but we do.
Right.
It's not about taking a name and a logo and stamping it on a product, right? It's a brand is the heart and soul and imagination of what goes into it. And digital is a medium to help you tell that story better, because, and it's a wonderful medium. So I don't think that you can, very soon this line will blur. Now it's like D2C, D2C. So you'll have food companies and food tech companies, right? In 10 years, everybody will have to be a food tech company. And then it'll be the next
right.
wave. So like, the you know, it's that wave. And we are in the midst of that wave, and it's a very exciting time.
So that was Shorvi's insightful take on building up a new age D2C brand. And if you'd like to try out the delicious range of Slurp Farm products, then do check out their website, slurpfarm.com. That's slurpfarm.com.
If you like the Founder Thesis podcast, then do check out our other shows on subjects like marketing, technology, career advice, books, and drama. Visit thepodium.in, that is thepodium.in, for a complete list of all our shows.